On tonight's episode of Sanity Lounge, we are happy to welcome Jason Leppo into the studio. Jason has a storied history of discovering the guitar at a young age. Jay immediately jumped into live gigs in downtown Baltimore and D.C. at the exact time in the mid-80s when new-style D.C. juggernauts like Bad Brains, Fugazi, and Jawbox were ruling the scene. Over the last 35 years, he has been all over the world doing everything from teaching English in China to being a personal assistant to one of the top global action stars of the late 90s. Join us for a fascinating conversation that stretches from downtown Baltimore to the streets of Hong Kong and back to Hanover. This is Sanity Lounge.
In the lounge today, we have Jason Leppo, who is kin to our the half of Sanity Lounge, Brian Leppo. He's also a guitar virtuoso and the lead guitar on the Sanity Lounge theme song, among the many other projects that he's working on.
He's the lead guitar of Gravedigger's Biscuits currently, and he's the filling guitarist for Brent Bauer when Brent has other duties to do. Jason is the savior that will come in and play with Making Waves occasionally throughout the year and stuff like that. He also recently had been in the Hepcats, which was a Pennsylvania swing band.
That was good.
Incredible.
You sent me that YouTube video.
Oh, my gosh. Incredible. But he is my blood, and I love him, and it's good to see you, buddy.
Love you back, bro. Yeah, it's good to be here.
Welcome.
I'm so excited to join the Sanity Lounge.
I need more sanity. Yeah. I know. That's the whole concept of the lounge.
Everyone.
Boy, do I need it. But yes.
I know, man. Well, look, so let me, you know, We're going to kind of go all over the place. Eventually, I want to land on Gravedigger's Biscuits. I have something to tell you about Gravedigger's Biscuits that'll blow your face off once we get...
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, once we get to it.
I'm going to be kind of along for the ride on this one.
Right.
I have questions for you, but I'm going to let you guys kind of
run
the show here. But I have some things.
Yeah, what it boils down to is that, you know, Jay and I have a lot of history. You knew Jay through the years. Yeah, like, occasionally he'd pop up and everything like that. So my earliest memory, right, of music in general was you. And I don't know if you know that or not, but I used to be at Mum Leppo's, and God rest her soul. I used to be at Mum Leppo's, and you would always be playing the guitar. Always. Yeah. And you would disappear. Like, all of a sudden, I'd hear the guitar 24/7, and then it wouldn't be there. And I'd go, "Where's Jay?" And she'd go, "I don't know. He's out." And I would go into your room, and I found AC/DC's Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap. And I put it on, and I was like, "Oh my God." And so anyway, you were just kind of like this mystery to me. You know what I'm saying? And so years go through, and I see you when I see you, and it's always like, "Well, Jay's in, you know, downtown Baltimore, you know, working at a Chinese restaurant." Yeah. And he's like, "I feel like you were like 17 or something." And I'm going,
"True."
I'm going, "What?" You know, so anyway, let's talk about that. Like, what?
That's where the infamous dream set lived.
And keep in mind, my earliest memory was Mum Leppo and you being at Mum Leppo's.
And the drum set that stayed there.
Oh, right. Well, that eventually, his whatever bands he was in would practice.
Well, they were very supportive. I'll give them that. They didn't always like the choice of musical style
so much. It's so funny.
But they were very supportive in many, many ways.
Right. So tell me, when did you first pick up the guitar?
I believe my dad, Bruce, had a acoustic guitar laying around, and I know he liked to play it from time to time, but, you know, he only knew maybe one or two songs, and so, you know, I had an interest in the instrument. I was originally drawn to the drums.
Is that right?
Yes. I was a short stint as a violinist in the fourth grade and just didn't take it seriously enough. And, you know, I don't know what it was. It just didn't stick as much with me, but I really wanted a drum set, wanted to play drums.
And for the record, Uncle Bruce, your father, was the right. drummer and of the last.
Did I worked for Bruce, didn't I? At EIG?
Maybe. Is that a technical yes. type? It's possible.
I worked on the assembly line there.
I mean, he does.
He fired me.
No.
Might not be the same guy.
Nah.
It was your uncle, though. No, who
yeah,
was
but
it? He
Bruce
had a beard.
Is,
he had the beard.
No, that's not Bruce.
Look, I'll be like, oh, you're talking about Richard.
I can't remember his name, but
I can't vouch
he's
for
one of your uncles, but he fired me because I used to fall asleep.
I got to know. Now I'm in.
I know. It's Richard. It should be Richard.
Yeah,
right?
But EIG.
No. Yeah, it was in Hunt Valley. It was like we made circuit boards.
Oh.
And he was the boss. He hired me, and then he fired me.
That's incredible. Oh, wow. Blood uncle?
Yes.
Well, you know, it could have been. Was it at Unitote? Or
what's that?
Unitote. I think they used to be the one that made cash registers and stuff like that, and maybe some of these boards and stuff.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was down in Hunt Valley.
Do we know anyone?
Well, he worked down there in the 70s.
Who, Richard?
No, this maybe, was in the
was
70s.
It, did your mother have a brother?
Yeah, Uncle Ricky, but I don't think he ever had a beard.
He's not technical.
He's not technical. Yeah, he ain't technical.
That's fine.
Yeah. That's incredible, though. If that's true. No, I feel like I remember that.
Oh, that's true.
But I just don't know who it could be. Like,
oh, man, I can't remember.
Damn, no. Uncle Bruce is soft-spoken Uncle Bruce, who's my dad's brother.
Right, sure.
Right? Yeah. And he's very artsy. He's very, like... You know, he used to install cable, which mm-hmm. is why I thought maybe, you know, right. in like the Twitterverse or something, you may have worked with him or something like that. But he was never a boss.
No, it was one of those things where, I mean, your family hired me for this job.
Right,
it
right.
was a good job.
Right, right.
But I was still like, we were drinking whiskey
sure.
on a Tuesday night
yeah, man,
until
yeah.
we couldn't see straight. And then I was waking up and going to work.
Right, right.
And then falling asleep.
It was a just fine.
You were going to work and waking up and going to work?
At my station, no. I remember he probably
didn't get that far.
It was a just fire.
He was like, "I'm sorry, I was like, "I completely understand."
He said,
I knew it wasn't gonna work out.
I mean, that's incredible.
No,
I
that's
got
awesome.
That. Damn. Well, so anyway, so Bruce was a drummer.
Yep.
And he was in my dad's band. Him and my dad and two other guys.
See, we come
band.
From a musical family.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah,
it's
you
so
do.
Weird. Like, it never occurs to me. I always think of dad as a hard ass, like, sports guy.
Yeah, I don't
like
know. I mean, but I'm just finding this out myself. I didn't know your dad was
impeccable musical taste.
Yeah. So, listen, to this day,
dancing.
People will come up to me at, like, Fagers, like, mm-hmm. people who knew dad.
Yep.
And will, like, Steve Holland will come up to me, mm-hmm. and he's an older guy, and he'll go, "No one could move like Sterling Leppo
dancing."
Oh yeah, listen. Yeah.
I feel like he would. He reminds me that what you just said reminds me of Tom Jones.
Listen, I did not see him at this point in his career.
Right,
but apparently he could do the full split, straight up, back down, full
That's
split.
Wild.
And, like, he was like James Brown.
I right. have multiple firsthand accounts, witnesses to all of this.
Really?
Let me tell you what my mother said. My mother, Sue. Mm-hmm. Sue McLean back in the day. But anyway, she told me that he came running out onto the stage, jumped off the stage at one point, and hit the split while he was landing on the dance floor.
My father.
This is fascinating.
It's Sterling.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's like
fascinating.
Yeah.
And multiple people have told me that. Yeah. And so Bruce
Legendary.
Was the drummer of
right.
that band. And my dad wasn't a guitar player or anything. He was the front man
God.
Of that band. And they were called The Last.
What if there was footage somewhere?
Well, we did when dad and mom had their 50th anniversary or maybe or something major.
Mm-hmm. It was his 60th birthday.
Maybe.
I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Me and Jason and Uncle Bruce mm-hmm. practiced for like months.
A brief set.
Yeah,
of,
and we did a brief set of The Last. Like we did Gloria and, you know, like all
Knock
these
on wood.
Donna for my mother.
Right.
And Dad, we invited him up and he sang and everything like that.
Oh my God, yeah. That's amazing.
And that was the last time, God rest his soul, with Chippy. You know, when Chippy was happy, that was the last time Chippy was happy.
And that wasn't that far from here.
Yeah. So listen, we went a little heavy there, but it's good stuff.
Yep.
So you got into the guitar eventually after negating the
drums
violin,
weren't an option for me, even though I wanted it.
Right.
It was the guitar, and that was the most handy. But remember, I got my first guitar it must have been 1982. It was Christmas. And got that thing, and I don't want to put it down. It's my first guitar, but it was like a lot of people's first guitars. It was a real cheapy kind of a knockoff from Sears or something, you know, and the strings were like a mile off the fretboard.
right.
Like trying to dig your fingers. Like you have to really want to learn to play to put up with that for a while. But I did. I was into it. And I was on a mission to learn some songs to play with my friend that I had just met when I moved to Westminster, right? That was the last the winter I had when I moved to Westminster and eventually grew up with my friends and started playing in bands and stuff in Westminster.
Right.
That was the beginning. And
now, you never took lessons, though.
I didn't at first, but after about 6 months or so, I did. I started taking lessons in Westminster at Christie Music, and Bob Coffey, many mm-hmm. listeners may know locally, was a legendary guy in the music business, had a store in Westminster for a long time, and he was one of the employees at this store at the time.
Of Christie Music. I remember Christie Music.
So I took a couple lessons there for a while. I had a couple of teachers, and one kind of I settled on. He was a young guy. He was just out of high school. His name's Steve May. And he was a great, great guitar player. He was much closer in age, so I could relate to him, because some of the older guys that were teaching were like teaching you from Mel Bay books and stuff like that. And it's like that had held no interest to me whatsoever. I just wanted to learn how to play a song. I wanted practical advice on how to approach the guitar, and being able to watch people like him, who was a very fluid and well-taught player, very disciplined too, was mind-changing for me. So I got pretty good in a short period of time, because I focused all the energy I should have been focusing on my schoolwork into music.
Right.
So,
well, I just remember 24/7, like if you were around, it was the radio was on and you were just leaned over in front of the radio, just trying.
Yep. Or backing the record up and trying to hear it again.
Yep.
Cause that was the dinosaur days still. It was a pre-digital world for all intents and purposes, you know?
Now, when you, from there, like, cause in, as my memory goes, it's like that happened. And then all of a sudden I feel like you were in a band and you were playing out like in Baltimore. Is that how it happened, or did you have like a couple bands, like, you know what I mean?
So middle school, I think, you know, I'm looking back at that age. I came in halfway through middle school in Westminster in 82, and I didn't know anybody yet, but that was when I met my first musical friend, my very first, very close friendship that I made in Westminster was with a guy named John Graham. And he was a wonderful guy. He was really, really smart, had kind of like academic type of parents, you know, they were quite smart and stuff. And I was really impressed with that, just because, you know, a lot of other friends had kind of like weird broken homes and stuff, and his wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. He had an older brother and older sister, and they were into music and had awesome record collections. Cheech and Chong were the first times that I heard them over there, you know. But anyway, he was a lovely guy, and we both were starting guitar at the same time. So we were on the same level. We liked the same music. We loved Led Zeppelin. We loved Jimi Hendrix. We loved everything. As far as that was, you know, I got into other music earlier with some of the punk music back when I was younger, was by virtue of being around older kids. And I seem to have a history of that, having friends that are older than me, you know, between 4 to 6 years older, mm-hmm. and as, you know, a general rule of thumb. And like, when I start to count all the friends I have from that generation, I feel like, wow, I wonder what's up with that. I don't know why that happened, but it did. And I learned about music that was underground, you know, Black Flag, yep. and Bad Brains and Minor Threat and all that stuff. And it was fascinating to me. I just didn't get it because it was just like skate punk music, you know, and it was kind of aggressive and it wasn't as musical to me then. But
were you aware at that moment that some of those bands had local like close roots or whatever? Didn't Bad Brains, weren't they from DC or was that not? Or Fugazi or somebody.
At that time, it could have been across the country for me because I wasn't traveling right. at that age.
I got you.
So it didn't matter. But I knew Minor Threat was supposedly a band that was local and stuff. And I was around kids who were skateboarding and stuff, like Rob Oswald.
Right.
You know, he was one of the guys. And, you know, he was also playing drums even back then. And so, you know, local people, musicians were always on my radar back then and just got to be lucky enough to play with somebody like that. That guy's a really great caliber drummer.
That's Rob of Jade's Rob.
Robert Oswald.
Yes. I'm hogging the questions.
No, it's fine. Yeah. I was just going to ask, like back then, like even starting out with guitar, like who were your influences? Like why did you decide, like what drew you to start playing the guitar?
Right. So for me, like guitar was almost an escape. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a latchkey kid, right? You know, so I kind of came and went as I wanted to in a way. But I also, you know, did have some discipline attempted on me, but it didn't stick too well because I was born with a really hard head and stubborn.
I never saw it. I'm telling you.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So I would regularly go out and do things, and regardless of whether I had any permission to do it or not, you know, and I would suffer the consequences when I eventually returned with my tail between my legs, but I just kept doing it anyway. But I knew I was into something really special when I learned about punk music because it was much more accessible to me. You didn't have to play other people's music perfectly. And in fact, you know, if you mess up, I mean, no one really knows anyway because it's all part of the music. So
right.
It seemed a lot more freedom for people like me to express myself. And, you know, seeing some of the early shows, the earliest shows that I think I remember seeing were when I was playing with other bands on the same bill at a party. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like actually going to live shows, I'd never been taken to a show by anybody before. So, yeah, just playing with other bands was my first exposure, and you see another band, and it was a scene. And then from then, those guys are going to play at the Utah Street Clubhouse, you know, in Baltimore on Utah and Mulberry Street, that infamous place that Jules opened back in the early 80s. And it was an all-ages place. You didn't have to... You know, there was no drinking. There was no bar. There was mm-hmm. barely a functional toilet, kind of like CBGBs of the our day. That was our CBGBs.
And how old were you at this point?
So that whole thing started when I was 12.
Yeah.
But
wow. It was in Baltimore City. That's what I mean. Like, man,
I wasn't going to shows until I was 14.
Okay. Right. I just remember you were very young. And my mother, you know, Donna, she's always like, Jason's in the city, I think. You know, that kind
of
thing.
Going to shows at 14, but you were playing shows at 12.
So we were playing amongst ourselves, right, at that age. And then when we got to high school, then we started to venture out because, hey, it's an all-ages gig, so they can't refuse us for our age.
Right.
And that was the game changer, you know. And Ian Mackay and the Discord people and, you know, his tight-knit group of fellow like-minded musicians and skaters and stuff had their scene. And that was what they wanted to create out of it was this, you know, sense of, hey, you can't just block us out because we're not here to drink, you know. We're right. here for the music. We don't right. care about drinking. So they started the whole X on your hands thing. And so they, meaning you're straight edge, you're underage, not drinking. And it became a symbol of the straight edge youth. But I took a slightly different turn on that road. That was where I parted ways with.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't that wild? Yeah, like, I just remember, cool story, you know, being young and not knowing where you were. My mother being like, "Oh, I worry about Jason. You know, he's playing in Baltimore," and I'm going,
"It was sketchy.
He's playing in Baltimore. Like, what do you mean?
It was sketchy as heck back then. You know, because we would." Get in a car full of people who are probably fucked up.
Right.
We're driving somewhere we've never been.
Right.
And everybody's stoned or fucked up or something. And we're looking for some place and we're getting lost and we're in really shady parts of town.
Sure.
And, you know, eventually you get there, you know, but you think of all the trouble and craziness you go through and you get there and then it's sold out and you're on the streets walking around trying to figure out what you're going to do for 3 hours, you know.
I mean, that's so wild, dude.
Yeah. But I mean, you look back on it and it's kind of different. It has a patina to it now, you know?
So did you guys tighten up as a band during those years, like the Beatles and, you know, or did you guys just, were you going hard and fast, not trying to really
evolve? We always had good drummers, you know, and that's what set us apart. Because
Rob
other than
is...
that,
incredible. I've never met the man, but his style.
Well, starting
the,
all the way back
this
in
the Jade
high school.
Days?
This is pre-Jade. Even pre-Jade. Right? So the original band was Generic Youth.
Oh my God, I remember that.
Generic Youth. That was our skate punk band. And Dave had the half pipe in the backyard that they built from scratch.
Dave who, for the people at home?
Dave Ferraro. Yes.
Westminster Pike. It was one of the, like, it was one of the only ones, like a half pipe on the East Coast. Or there was some kind of like a legend.
We
about
had a quarter
pipe
in our neighborhood that Wayne Stocksleger built.
This was a half pipe.
And it was full, and it was a nice one, too. Yeah. They knew what they were doing. They studied other people that did it. And he's always been a very thorough guy, Dave. And he's the man. He totally did that up. And his family are ultra cool for letting him do it in the backyard.
Yeah, that was in my neighborhood.
Yeah, because you'd have people from all over the place. You know, they would go skate somewhere, whether it's Lansdowne or Shrewsbury or different places, and then people would come and follow them and be skating in his backyard from all over the place. Yeah, we rode up from Virginia Beach. Like, holy shit.
I remember.
You see who's on his half pipe back there? They're killing it, man.
I remember riding my bike to Burger King past the half pipe all the time, and it was like Woodstock. Like, the whole backyard was packed with people. Like, it very well may have been like relevant people. It was in the 80s.
Know, right.
It was in
the
80s. I mean,
the skate scene back in the 80s.
That
was
the band that I formed with Dave, and he was originally the vocalist, and he wrote the lyrics of the songs and came up with the ideas for it. And I would sit there with him and just write off music or what I thought was cool. And we made a little recording of it. You know, we were impressed with it. We made a demo locally in Carroll County. And it really wasn't half bad. I wish I could say I had a copy of it, but I don't. And I'm doubtful that anybody may still have
this
any copy
cassette,
of that.
A cassette?
Yes, but the superintendent of Carroll County Schools, Mr. Stephen Locker, Dr. Stephen Locker, is our original drummer.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, and he was
Generic
awesome.
Youth.
Did you say the current superintendent?
I believe it's Stephen Lockhart. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, he was one of my classmates, and he was our original drummer. We used to practice. Our very first practices were in his family home basement. So.
Right.
That's awesome.
So we had him for a while, and then we kind of outgrew that situation. He was had a lot of other things, obviously.
Right.
But
he's a doctor.
Yeah, his dad's the same. He's a very well educated family and venerable family. But we got a guy named Grant Sheehan from South Carroll. He's in Westminster, but closer to where you live, B.
Right.
And he was a really great hardcore thrash drummer. He wanted to play faster. He wanted to play thrashier. And it got to the point where my tastes weren't quite as fast as his. And it was it seemed like after we did a little bit, our best stuff was with him. We actually had a nice little set of music and we could play a show, and we did. We played some shows in Baltimore and parties and wherever we could, you know, at that age. And it was a lot of fun, but eventually it kind of fell apart because drummer, we weren't seeing eye to eye.
Right.
But that led, fortunately, to what happened later, which is with somebody who I've known for many years before that. When I was a kid, he was one of the skater kids in the neighborhood, and we looked up to him and Mark and other people, and they're the ones that turned us on to this kind of music, right? Right. I remember walking home from a baseball game that I had, and I was walking through the street, still had my uniform on. He's like, "Mr. Baseball." And then we would start talking, you know, and he just, this little kid in here with his baseball mitt into the listening room where they got all these records out. And he's like, "Check this out," you know.
Right.
It was like he wanted to see that expression, you know. Yeah. Everybody loves that. When you got something you like or something you're excited about, you want to play it and get other people's reactions. I think I was the guinea pig for that.
Sure.
So anyway, that was the introduction to the style, but Rob was one of those guys.
So that is the end of Generic Youth. You guys just kind of fizzle out and immediately start Jade, or?
Yeah, I mean, everything was there, but the name wasn't there yet. And the name was picked because we couldn't decide on a name.
And Jade stood for?
Jason and Dave Experience.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Simple, I mean, to the point, and works.
It was just one of those things, and it just seemed like, okay, let's just call it that. But yeah, once Rob joined, the situation got dramatically better. And, you know, I'm just going to lay it out, my love for the drums, because with a good drummer, even with a bad drummer, it's still better than no drums.
Sure.
Most of the time.
Yeah, so you can argue.
Most
it.
Of
right,
the time.
Right. It's got to be a uniquely
I
got to
put a little caveat there because somebody's going to pop up and they're going to be proven wrong. But, but yeah, that guy is so incredible. And, you know, it spoils you as a musician. I mean, it kills you because, you know, if somebody's that good, there's not a good likelihood they're going to stick with playing me very long.
Right.
They're going to find much better opportunities, and I would take them too. But, you know, it is hard to follow an act like that.
Well,
know?
So you guys, though, recorded rather quickly, it seems. Am I, like, mm-hmm. all of a sudden you're like, hey, I have an album. Like, what grade? Were you out of high school, or were you still in high school?
We were just out of high school, and we knew what we wanted to do, and we were already doing it live. So we kind of hit the ground running from that point on. But, you know, we never had a singer. And originally Dave sang in the old band, but he learned guitar in the meantime, in the last years of high school, and got to be a really good rhythm guitar player. And so we had that thing going on. That was our best dynamic, having great drummer and having the dynamic with the two guitars. Then we got Ron. We got Ronnie boy.
Ron.
Once Ron came into the picture, it was complete.
Ron's nasty. Like, but was Ron nasty back then as he is now? Or was
the
he
Ron?
Just... Yeah, our Ron.
Ronald
of Grave Digger's Biscuit.
Ronald Rossback from Dundalk, Maryland.
Yeah.
Yes, and he is a badass bass player. And once he, you know, he was working, you know, I like to describe my life, if I'm really thinking about it, almost like I'm like a Forrest Gump.
Right.
You know, I'm like wandering through life almost blindly, and I'm stumbling into things that are really interesting mm-hmm. most of the time that aren't bad, you know. So I've had these experiences, and, you know, for a while, if we get away from Rob for a second, there's a sidetrack to the story with our drummer, with Jade. So Rob was the original drummer. We started having some problems. I guess, you know, Rob had different interests at the time.
Right.
Put it that way. You know, he was kind of into a spiritual thing. And it wasn't necessarily jiving with what was going on in the music stuff. So we kind of took a break from that. And we found this guy. I found him at a Dag Nasty show at the 930 Club, the old 930 Club in Washington, D.C. on F Street. And we were, I was in the basement. I just wandered down there. Again, Forrest Gump, right? Down in the dressing room. It's a crowd of people. Everybody's talking, having a good time and stuff in their own little worlds and conversations, drinking beer, eating pizza. And so I kind of am standing in an area listening to one of my guitar idols, Brian Baker. And Dag Nasty was the headliner of the show, but, you know, he was the guy I always wanted to emulate back in those days. He was one of the coolest guitarists for my money. He still is. But heard him talking about his influences to somebody, and he said Johnny Marr was one of his greatest influences from the Smiths. Mm-hmm. And I remember being really taken back by hearing that, because it was totally unexpected based on what I was hearing from his style of playing. I wasn't hearing Johnny Marr there.
Right.
But
Were you offended by that?
Not at all. It jarred something loose in my brain that made me realize that the anarchy of punk music, the beauty of the anarchy is it's an anarchy of genres. Anything could cross anything. And that was when I really started to realize that, you know. And DC also being the bands like Bad Brains, mm-hmm. where you're fusing reggae and hardcore punk and, you know, trouble funk, go-go music, right? So
yeah, how about that?
Right, I mean, so that leads me perfectly segs into this portion of the discussion of Jade drummers, and that is Brandon Finley. And Brandon is a guy from Silver Spring. He knows and grew up with a lot of the other people in the DC punk scene, but he is more of a go-go, you know, kind of a drummer. You know, I mean, this guy is phenomenal to a point where he could, and I think he has at least on one occasion played with Prince, mm-hmm. wow. played with all top level of stars, you know, who was the Queen Latifah? He played right. on an award show with her.
Wow.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of big stuff like that, but he also was the drummer for Chuck Brown, right? So Chuck Brown, DC Go-Go Godfather, right? He started playing with him when their original drummer left to play with Miles Davis. Hmm. So he was a working drummer for the music scene. And we happened to meet at that dressing room because he was friends with someone there and I was talking to him and I was looking for a drummer. They said, you need to talk to him. And I did. And he was a really cool guy. And we kind of started up a friendship because he was interested in punk music and wanted to lean in on that part of it and see what it was like. And that was right around the time when Living Color was starting up too. Mm-hmm. You know, it was in that same time.
The Cult of Personality, yeah. when they're hitting.
They weren't big.
It wasn't that. It was
no, they weren't
that.
Like that. It was before that, right? Because yeah. I did see them. I saw
would say
them.
That was the hit that set them up.
Cult right. of Personality, yeah. I saw them open for Soul Asylum at the old 930 Club.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, they were the opening act for yeah. Soul Asylum. That's yeah, awesome. But they killed it then. But
so I saw at one of the recent Hot Augusts, I saw Galactic.
Oh, Stanton Moore.
Baby. Yes.
But the lead singer for the band at that moment was Corey Glover.
Oh, wow.
It was yeah. fantastic.
Wow. I yeah. wonder how
He's
that.
He's a great frontman.
It was great.
Yeah. But that, yeah, so it was that vibe, that fusion, you know, like I said, that's the anarchy that I think it really symbolizes what's great about that genre. But yeah, with all that kind of stuff going on, we were trying to do that too. So as a punk group who were limited to three chords or whatever, and we're starting to play with the caliber of drummer like this after playing with Rob too. And it's funny because their styles are so different.
Rob's style
so different.
Yeah, Rob is you can't emulate him. Like, it's so out there, but it's awesome. I mean, he's incredible, but it's so hard to replicate.
It what, is. It's you know. A it's a thing of stripped down and funky and tricky too. But then a really busy, more busy style of playing, and yeah, sometimes it's hard to get one to do the other, you know. It was hard to get Rob to strip it down sometimes, and it was equally hard to get Brandon to kind of fill it out a little bit more, because you know, when you're just playing a power chord on a guitar, it's like if you have drums that are really sparse, it kind of leaves a lot of space, and we weren't very comfortable with our vocals at right. the time, so it would be nice to have something else to go in that space, but we didn't, because vocals were the Achilles heel of our Jade musical project.
So when you guys, where did you record that album?
The
like the one
original
I
original recording that we did, we only released one vinyl record. An EP, 12-inch EP with four songs on it that lasts for probably like maybe 12 and a half, 13 minutes total running time. But that was paid for at least the production of it was by me personally. And I think I don't have much money these days, but back then,
I was gonna say, how the hell?
I don't even know where I came up with it, but I was the bankroll. So we recorded several different sessions when we had enough money to get enough time. And Brandon led the production, the recording, and all that. So we left it up to him because he had some experience with it that we hadn't. And it was interesting. We're never really satisfied with the mixes. And so we had the tapes. And then we had another friend from another old days, but his name's Brian Hemler. And he's a musician and also a studio engineer down at Lion and Fox Studios back in the day in D.C. So we took our recordings to him and we finished them there. And we were a little bit happier with the production of it, but still overall not very happy with how that turned out, how it sounded. And I think it's mainly because, and even though I look back on it, it's a pretty short period of time. It was probably over the span of a year. But it felt back then like it was taking forever, and we had literally evolved so far musically by the end of that process that the record didn't seem relevant anymore.
Right, right. Yeah.
So that was the downside, but we had to release it because we had just signed with Merkin, Joe Goldsboro, Baltimore music legend and a Reptile House founding member. Discord. They were, I think, besides Lungfish, the only Baltimore Discord band. And they were the first Discord band that I saw, and they were very influential to me musically. You know, I looked up to those guys. And so anyway, he was signing bands to his new label, Merkin. And this is in the late 80s, probably early 90s.
I was young.
Quite
as
a
shit.
Few bands. You know, some of the bands he got were really, really good, like the Almighty Senators, Monkey Spank, Brian Rice. Yeah, genius band. Brian is a great musician. He's out in Austin, Texas for a while, still doing music.
I've seen Warren Bowes several times.
Warren
recently.
Is a monster. Yeah. I love Warren. Great player. Hopefully he's doing better now too.
I've seen him. He just played a Woodshed show. He plays with a band called Rachel Hall. He plays with our first guest, Ricky Wise. They do a stint during the summer. Usually, I guess during the summer a lot. They play. Ricky plays the bass and Warren's on the guitar for
nice.
That.
They play
Planche a lot.
Always wanted to play with Warren. Hopefully I'll get a chance one day. I played with Jack back in the day, Jack Denning, bass player for Almighty Senators. He wasn't in the band back then, but it was. We were very excited at the time that people were interested in our music. You know, it was really what we were all looking for. And anyway, it got released, you know, eventually Joe took over and got the record mastered and pressed for us and stuff. We did the artwork ourselves, but with his help and his, you know, connections for distribution, we made it. We didn't get very far in trying to support it, unfortunately. The wheels started to fall off after that as far as being able to get much attention from the record label. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on. It was a very dark period in a lot of people's lives in Baltimore for many reasons, drugs being one of them.
Right.
And so, you know, they're always on the periphery of these things, and you take a wrong step and you could really derail all of your hopes and dreams. And you know what? If you survive and live, then you might want to be thankful for that, because there's quite a few cats that didn't make it.
Right.
And I knew a lot of them there. A lot of them were my friends.
Right.
But it was a weird time. And
now, let me ask you, you guys went in a van somewhere. Like, did you guys go on like a mini tour and the wheels fell off? Or did you guys, like, did the band officially call it quits, or was it you got stopped?
No, that was the best part of the band was our live performances, because, again, back to Rob and drummers and in general, you know, when you got a really good drummer behind the set, that a lot of the focus of attention is on the drummer. And, you know, maybe it should be on the singer or whatever, and that could be the case once in a while, but If you haven't seen Rob play, you haven't gone on YouTube or watched Karma to Burn or any of the other things that he's been in, he's a force of nature, man.
He's a wild man.
He's wild. Yeah. And he beats the living tar out of his equipment. I've never seen any. Well, maybe Joey Castillo. I mean, when I watch him play, that reminds me of Rob, the way he plays. It's just everything is balls to the wall, hard.
Right.
You know, no matter how fast it is, he's still hitting hard. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I was telling you about the Descendants show I saw the other night, and boy, that was a good one. I haven't seen them since 86.
The Descendants.
1986. Yeah. And I saw them the other night with my 14-year-old daughter, Sophia.
Tell them the lineup.
I saw the Circle Jerks.
Right. The Adolescents, the Circle Jerks, and the Descendants, all from the same area of Southern California. Yeah. And Descendants are my daughter's favorite band.
That's awesome.
How awesome is that in general? But I'm so glad I got an opportunity to take her to see him. We were in the front row, got my face kicked in multiple times by crowd surfers.
Was that at Soundstage?
That was at
where was it?
That was at the Rams Head Live.
Oh, Rams Head. Okay.
And so there was a space there where they dump them off. Yep. But I tell you, I don't mind the crowd surfing. I could handle that, you know, getting kicked and stuff. But I was terrified for the crowd surfers because one of them almost got a concussion.
It's right? Like you're old now. Yeah. It's so funny. You're going, guys, please.
Dude, even Keith Morris and the Circle Jerks kind of called him out and said, you know, why, man? Why? You're going to have a concussion, man. So it kind of stopped for a
while. Safety first these days, man. Safety first.
I think a lot of people, especially young ones too, but they're old and young crowd surfing, but they realize how good this is to have this, you know, because this is high energy stuff. And it's like not the kind of stuff you play in a coffee shop, you know. It's like it's going to be crazy if it's done right. And
He said the funniest thing to me a while ago. He was like, because he's over the past 2 years, he's recently revisited these old school punk acts that have come around. And I think you saw like the Dead Kennedys or somebody last year. You saw somebody.
Circle Jerks, yeah.
Well, he was like, I said, well, what'd they play? He's like, well, they can play their whole catalog in 12 minutes. Have to play covers.
I mean, it's funny that we're talking about this music. It just popped into my head something I heard today. The Russian Republic of Croatia just banned music that's too slow and too fast. So they banned music that's below 80 beats per minute and above 120 beats per minute.
Wow.
Banned. Oh, man. Can't listen to it.
Why?
I don't know. Why because it's the Russian Republic.
Yeah, but why are they afraid of those rhythms?
I don't
know. Like, why
isn't
specifically
that a weird thing?
What a weird rule.
In fact, I heard it on the way here, and I was like, that's
Alexi, there's
crazy.
Too much treble on that. Take it down.
Right, it's like Footloose. It's Footloose.
But I was just music that's too slow or too fast is out.
That's obnoxious
in Croatia.
What's
up,
Croatia? Fuckers.
But it's funny because the song that was on when I was driving here was The Pretenders, and the dude was like, it's 97 beats a minute, so they're safe. Like, you can listen to Pretenders in Croatia.
Wow, what a weird law.
But you probably can't listen to Circle Jerks, I would imagine. They're probably over 120 beats per minute.
Yeah, they're over 120.
The beauty of that band, though, I'll have to tell you, the Descendants were on spot, man. I mean, the difference between, I was talking about this earlier, right, but we kind of saved it for an opportune moment, and talking about the different style between two drummers. All right, the Descendants and the Circle Jerks. So, you know, both bands, very aggressive, fast style punk music. But the Circle Jerks drumming generally is quite busy and really hard hitting.
Right.
Really, really hard hitting with Joey. And Bill Stevenson's approach is very different. He's a very light touch.
Right.
And he kind of just adds these little jazzy things in there, you know. It's such a different style, but they both really work, you know.
Yeah, because that's the thing is, I recall at some point you were gone for a minute, not too long, but like you were out somewhere on the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did that, like, was that was that a train wreck or was it a successful, because you guys were in a van,
It was success for us. It was a 3-week odyssey.
Okay.
Yeah, man, it was wild. And the coolest part was that we were really unknown. We had never toured in any of these places before, so this was all new for us. And for the most part, things went okay.
Where was it? All over?
So we did a southern tour, but we never got further than San Diego, California. So when we got to California, we were hoping to get to Los Angeles, keep it going all the way up to Seattle, but it wasn't in the cards for us. We just had incompetent help. You know, we didn't know any context. We didn't have the secret list that, you know, a lot of the old school bands kind of had going around with each other. We didn't have one of those. We were just trying to do it ourselves because, like I said, at the time, a record label kind of was incapable of really giving us any support or help. So it was like, guys,
and what's more punk than
let's keep riding this as far as we can. Maybe something good will happen. And so we did. We just took off and had a good time. Did this couple week stint. Went down through the South. Went into Texas. Texas was the best part of the tour. We had more fun there. We were in Houston. And where else were we?
Just in general, because it was a different world.
People were more into it, I guess. You know, it seemed like we played at a place called Emo's, which was a pretty well known place there, and they have a crowd anyway. But they really liked us there, and we had a good time. We had a good party atmosphere in that town in general. We liked it.
Right.
It was fun. And so then we went to Arizona, and it was the same vibe. It was a really cool desert vibe, and Tucson, and the place we played was huge.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was huge. It was really wild. It was, and then we eventually made it to San Diego, where we all got sunburned on the beach, sitting there pre-dawn, just chilling, and the sun starts coming up, and before you know it, you know, however you were sitting there, you had a terrible sunburn. And it was rough. So, but yeah, we had a fun gig, UCSD, and that ended up being it, you know.
So it's safe to say that the demise of the band was poor management and drugs, ultimately.
It was just a series of some poor choices and, you know, being naive about how everything was supposed to work. Right. Just ignorant is more than I can say. I was so focused on music and playing, and that was the area that I felt good in. And the rest of it, I didn't really have to do that much. A lot of the planning and organizing of things, Dave was really good at. And so that was more of a thing where he would, you know, call Kenny at 9:30 Club and get us a gig there, put a lot of this stuff together. And so, everyone for different reasons started getting tired of their role and was kind of getting like, well, how come so-and-so doesn't do this? How come I'm doing that? Ronnie bought the van, so nobody could fault Ronnie. Dundog Ronnie bought a van for us to tour in. And that was, I don't even know how we could have done it without Ronnie.
Right. Wow. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, we poached Ronnie from Richard Taylor and the Ravers. That was the Brandon connection, right? So because of Brandon, the original drummer in Jade, original recorded drummer in Jade, we met Ronnie and we pilfered Ronnie. And he came over to the dark side with us.
Soft-spoken.
Unfortunately, he probably ruined his whole career.
Right, soft-spoken Ron.
But yeah. So once that kind of started to implode, we didn't have anything else to do. We came back and recorded with Tony, right? So Tony French.
Is that Oz Studios?
That wasn't Oz. That was, we did record at Oz, but that was different time periods. Okay. And most of the stuff we recorded at Oz, I don't have any copies of. The only copy of music I recorded at Oz that I have is the one that I produced myself with Drew Mazurek on the engineering.
Right.
And so, but I have that. But the stuff that I felt captured the vibe of the band best when we were right before the end was the stuff we recorded at Tony's factory studio, Hat Factory. And so he was kind of in the early 80s, was starting, I don't know if he was starting a label. I kind of had an idea that's what he wanted to do with it. But he had this big factory, you know, loft in Baltimore on Baltimore Street. And it used to be a hat factory. And that's why they call it that. But he was recording 16 track and stuff in there. But it was raw. It was what we were looking for because Oz was like really clean and really, you know, I don't think we knew how to deal with it. It was like it was too... It exposed too much of the stuff that we thought we were incompetent with. We're like, yeah. I wanted to sound more like it's falling down the stairs, you know, or right. whatever. But Tony, he helped us to really capture a live sound better where we were playing together more. And, you know, it was more fun. We started to experiment with overdubs because we felt more comfortable with him. So we, you know, put a couple of, you know, vocal tracks and then maybe an extra guitar track for a solo. But that was about it. Rob did a couple of percussion things where he had this like little like baby xylophone thing that he used.
Bells, right?
Yeah, or like bells. The screen from a fan, like a metal fan. He would like play that. I mean, it's just weird stuff. But
Shit did sound good. The Hat good Factory. Time.
The production quality, it really isn't that great because the mixes are so guitar heavy and mid heavy that they just drown out a lot of the nuance of the drums and the bass.
Right.
But you know that's just.
It was the era.
Yeah, but it was the first X album, Los Angeles. The songs are great. It's one of their best albums, but it was just produced a little kind of thin sounding. Right. You know?
Let me ask you this, and you can speak to this however you want, but what I recall is all of a sudden you were gone, and I wake up one day and I am told Jason took Pop's car and moved to China, and I thought it was a joke, and I'm going, what do you mean? And they're like, I don't think Pop, like, I was under the impression that no one knew you left. You just, they woke up one day and you moved to China. Mm-hmm. Is that how that went?
Pretty close. Pretty
close. Because it's like, that was kind of the vibe I got, was my mother was beside herself because she was like, now, keep in mind, this is, you know.
I didn't want anybody to try to talk me out of it because I was afraid they could.
Right.
Because, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, what, just so to start with, had you always considered China?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, like, what made you do that?
Yeah. You know, I wanted an adventure. I wanted a real life adventure that was not just going into the city and doing the same old thing of getting fucked up, looking for friends, drinking, running around. You know, going to shows, I mean, it was good fun, and it was, boy, you know, there was a lot of good sides to the party life, but it was already getting old mm-hmm. at that point, and I could see that there was this glaring sign in front of me that was warning me that if I keep going down this road, all the bad things happening to everybody else around me were going to start happening to me. So it was time for me to get out of town, and I had whatever reason. I just had something inside me that wanted more out of life. This was not enough. I didn't have enough yet, you know, and it was like, I'm not checking out, and I'm going to go on an adventure so I can get the hell away from all of this external influence in my life and start over, almost like become a new person.
In China. I mean, well, you were broke,
it wasn't
right?
China at first. It was in Japan at first.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
So first went to Japan, and I tried to make a go of it there for about a year, and it was very expensive. It was a Spartan lifestyle. But I met a friend there who was from England, and she talked about this place called Taiwan. And Taipei, to be specific, it's the capital of Taiwan, the Republic of China. Not to get political, but it's different than the People's Republic of China, in case you don't know. Spent some time there, and she had told me how great it was, and that it was more laid back than the vibe in Japan, which was, again, it was cool. it's everything you would expect to see in Japan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like they say it is. It's clean, it's beautiful, it's organized, it's polite, it's all that stuff. A little severe and brutal sometimes.
I'd say it's Shogun, baby. I mean, what Christ, that's the only
I mean, what did you do when you got there?
So I had studied Japanese for a couple years when I was, before I came back, between the time I finished high school and mm-hmm. between the time I left. I went to college, took college classes.
I didn't know that.
I was interested. I got interested in language, and I thought Japanese would be useful. And I remember, I think it was President Bush the first said mm-hmm. That people should learn Japanese and learn foreign languages. It could be very useful. And I thought, okay, that sounds interesting. It wasn't because he said it, but it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I found an interest in it from that angle. Wanted to learn a language I thought would be really useful and interesting. But the thing is, after being in Japan, I realized that, you know, Japanese is really useful if you're in Japan. But if you're not in Japan, you know, it can be pretty hard to find Japanese people sometimes. You know, they're not like a diaspora around the world as much as, right. say, Chinese, right? So that's the road that kind of led me to Taiwan, because they do speak Mandarin Chinese there, right? So, I became a student over there then, and I decided that, wow, I love this place. They love Americans here, so it's really, really safe, and, you know.
And this is like the mid-90s.
This is early 90s.
Early
90s. Yeah, early
90s. Now, how long did it take for you to make the jump from Japanese to Mandarin linguistically? Like,
oh, it was completely different.
That's what I'm thinking.
Completely different. But, it's still a challenge for me. I mean, I've lost a good deal of my fluency speaking. But I think I'm definitely better with listening now than I've ever been, just because it's much easier for me to retain understanding and comprehension than it is for me to always remember the right pronunciation for things or the right grammatical structure, you know. So since I don't use it, you know, even with my wife who's from Taiwan, we speak Chinglish sometimes, or we'll speak Chinese.
Nice.
We'll speak Chinese if we want to keep something on the down low, you know.
Right.
That's slick as shit.
Yeah.
But, you want to talk about somebody, it's you know, she'll start it too. You know, we'll be standing somewhere and she'll start telling me in Chinese, look at that dude, look at that, you know. Right. And I'm just like, no, I'm not looking at that. You're going to get me in trouble. I'm going to get clobbered.
So you said your wife's from Taiwan, but did you meet her there?
I did, yeah. I met her there, and funny, because it's around the same time I started working for the movie star, Mr. Kung Fu.
Right, Jet Li. Brian, yeah.
Look, I keep telling him. I was like,
that. Now, that leads perfectly into this whole rabbit hole.
I can't wait for this.
Yeah, so explain that. So you go to Taiwan. Is this, so you meet Shay, and then you
I don't. I hope this doesn't get out very far to the people, the authorities in Taiwan.
Right.
But I was there on a student and then also a visitor visa. Yeah. So, but you know, I was there just to, to learn Chinese, and I started doing that, and I had the good fortune to meet somebody, who was from Canada, and he was a model. He's like, you know, a really handsome dude, you know. He did modeling for like big modeling agencies, but also like runway stuff, you mm-hmm. know. Like he was a, not Gucci, but a Versace model.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, the guy was, he was a cool guy. I just met him at a cafe one day, you know, because, I mean, there's only so many foreigners over there. Sometimes
right.
you're going to run into
them.
You
got to stand out.
But we became friends, and, you know, he ended up calling me later, had this opportunity he wanted to tell me about, and it was working for this Chinese movie star, and he needed somebody to teach him English to also kind of just be around all the time, almost like a live-in type of a situation. Mm-hmm. So it's like you're a personal assistant sometimes. Sometimes you're an interpreter. Sometimes you're just like a dialogue coach, or you're just teaching him privately, teaching him how to speak English more fluently. He spoke nothing when I met him, literally not even
this
one
was
word.
Prior to, he hasn't done any American films at this point.
Right, this is in like, you know, not the midnight, what's right around 90.
And say who it is.
94, 95. Oh, so yeah, the guys, I'd never heard of him before. So I told some of my friends in Taiwan, told my wife, you know, I said, hey, look, you know this guy? This guy's name is Jet Li. And Li Lianjie is his Chinese name. And my wife about dropped on the floor.
I'm sure.
Right. I know who he is.
Yeah. So she explained to me what a big star he was. And I wasn't the big Kung Fu fan. You know, I didn't dislike the genre, but I just didn't know who he was. And so, yeah, when I found out, I was very excited. But, that led to that opportunity where he knew the guy. And the guy wanted to hire him for this position. But he was like, nah, I'm going to India and I'm going to study some guru or something. You know, that was his whole thing. So he didn't want to ruin his vibe by doing that. So that's why he called me. He wanted me to step in so he could cut loose.
I mean, that's crazy. That's incredible. He was just like, no,
right? So
I don't want to do that.
You see the Forrest Gump analogy?
Yeah.
It just keeps coming back.
Right.
And yes. So that's just another moment, another door that opened that probably shouldn't have, but it did. The universe does these things. You just have to be ready to step through. So I did, and started going down that road, and I was living in Hong Kong, based in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. I was traveling all over the world, traveling back to Taiwan.
Was he shooting movies and stuff, or was he in downtime?
Yeah, was the reason that he needed you for this, was that because of Lethal Weapon 4?
He was ready.
That was his first American movie. Yeah,
he was exploring his options for after he finished his current contract. Mm-hmm. He had a contract with Wynn Entertainment in Hong Kong, and he had to do so many movies with them. And that was very frustrating, I believe, personally for him, because he really couldn't get out of these things, even though he was already ready to take the next step. They were kind of holding him back because they could. And the guy who runs that company is a notorious son of a really big-time triad mafia gangster.
Really?
Yeah.
So he could not leave.
Oh, right? God. I had some great stories. I was around nothing but triad guys.
Is that right?
That's
the whole film business. That's it. They run everything. I heard the story about a British director who came over there to film once and hadn't hired the union people there, their people to work. Mm-hmm. And he got kidnapped. They had to pay ransom to get him back. And they did. And they got him back. But he's lucky to be alive.
That's, I mean, they don't play ransom.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, now he told me that. He like told me, don't discuss it. You don't talk about that in company.
Is this the Once Upon a Time in China era, or like
Fist
that kind
of... Legend.
Of, yeah, like old school Jet Li, like those movies.
It is, yeah. It's a little before... And up to during the time of, he did a movie called Black Mask.
I remember the cover.
Black Mask. And that's where I met Karen Malk. She's the actress who's in that opposite him. And she's a really cool lady from, she's half Portuguese, half Cantonese. And she's a singer, very popular singer and star all over China, all over the Asian world.
Wow.
Karen Malk. But there's met a lot of interesting people over there. All the Hong Kong business people, from Jackie Chan to Sammo Hung, all of them pretty much. I never met Andy Lau.
So let me ask you this: did you?
How about Bolo?
Bolo Young. Do you know who that is? That's the the big guy.
No, I've never met him.
Oh, man.
But I knew plenty of people who knew all of those people. Yeah. The people who knew Bruce Lee.
Right.
You know, people who personally knew him. Yeah, yeah.
So what about Oliver Stone? There was rumblings you met Oliver Stone, I recall.
That was one of the better people that I've was lucky enough to meet.
Was that Jet Li connected?
It was definitely Jet Li connected, because I have no business being in the same room as Mr. Oliver Stone, who is an incredible filmmaker and storyteller. And it was with Jet Li, and we had already done the movie in Texas with Sammo Hung directing, and that was the Once Upon a Time in China.
Oh, nice.
I forgot what number it was. It was one of the upper numbers, Roman numeral, something. Mm-hmm. But it was Once Upon a Time in China in America. That was the twist on it, because the other ones took place over there. But this was like, oh, the Wild West, you know, the Chinese were here too, you know. So they kind of incorporated their own story with the Native Americans. Huh. And it was an interesting story, you know, for what it was, and the budget they had, which I'm sure wasn't very much. But, you know, it was fairly decent. It was a really great experience to see how they make movies all the time. So that was with him on the set. But I definitely have not want to be in that business. I hurry up and wait is a whole new level at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's astounding.
Yeah, there's so much to wait on, and everything has to be perfect. And it's just very time consuming. I remember spending really long days on the set whenever he was filming, and it was just grueling. There was a lot of great people around, but it was just a grind after a while.
So Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone was very gracious, was very interested in Jet Li and his career, and had followed him quite a bit. And, just wanted to get to know the guy. Jet was on kind of a getting to know you tour of Hollywood. So it was people like Oliver Stone who were interested in talking to him and meeting with him. And building relationships and things.
And what
like
does
that
look like? Are you in a bar or a restaurant?
No, in his office. Yeah, wow. in Hollywood, in Santa Monica somewhere, I think, and in an office. I don't know if it was his office or if it was, you know, somebody else's, but it was an office where we met. And I remember doing a good deal of translating. You know, I had taught him pretty well up to that point, but, right. You know, once in a while I'd have to kind of give him a clue as to what was being said.
I mean, it's pretty wild. I mean, basically wherever Jet Li went for a period of time, you were standing
pretty
right
good.
Next to him.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. Went to, and I got to travel to a lot of places I otherwise might not have gotten to travel to.
Did he?
It was on his dime.
Did you ever try to take him?
Yeah, right. I tried to get him to teach me a little, but he thought the better of it, because he knew it's like, you know, he would tell me, he's like, nobody's faster than a bullet. Yeah. So, you know, it was better to not fight.
Right. Interesting.
Don't think you can learn something and then go out and use it, because it's probably not going to work out.
Right.
I mean, that's incredible, though. I mean, you just... Yeah. Roll off to China
and, Forrest Gump, dude.
And fall into a quasi movie gig.
Well, that's what makes
with the triads and Jackie Chan.
That's what makes me not afraid to give something up and start something different too. Because, you know, on the one hand, you're scared. I'm like, gosh, what happens if this happens or whatever? But, you know, I kind of get the same way of thinking. Well, man, if I'm stuck doing this all the time, I'm not free to do something else that I want to do. And so with Jet, it was that, you know, starting a family. So that was the main thing. I had to keep my family together. So traveling was just getting to be too much, and living on the road with him. So
how long did that go on for?
So that went on until 97. Mm-hmm. And that was when the handover of Hong Kong also happened. And it was not that long after that that I decided it was time for me to go. And that's when...
Was that politically motivated, or you just were homesick?
Well, no, it had nothing to do with the politics, although I had a... Put it to you this way. I had a feeling that things were going to work out a little differently than maybe some more optimistic people might have been thinking.
I see.
I'd been to China many times, and I've been to Hong Kong and lived in Hong Kong. I've been to Taiwan, I've been to Japan, I've been to Thailand, I've been to Nepal, I've been to India, I've been to England too. That's the only European country I've been to. That's next on my list. But, you know, all these places have their ups and downs, but I didn't think Hong Kong would be able to stay the same. You know, it's just incompatible. So I just kind of saw, this is eventually going to happen, what has come to pass. So, we We love our freedom.
Sure. Like now, let me ask you this. Did you guys, you and Shay tied the knot over there?
Yeah, yeah, at the consulate. They, you know, Taiwan doesn't officially have an, embassies, right? Because there's a political thing, right? Mm-hmm. So in 79, I think it was, Jimmy Carter changed our diplomatically recognized to People's Republic of China, which was started by Nixon and stuff. And Taiwan still remained, but it was just a different entity. It's like a limbo type of entity. They have not as many countries, very few countries have full diplomatic relations with them. But I think they're a wonderful country, one of the best in Asia, the smartest. They have incredible tech. And if you wonder why America loves Taiwan so much, it's partially for its people. It's really good people, really smart people, hardworking, well-educated, and they're great chip makers, right? So right. I guess the chip is the daddy. Mm-hmm. You need to have your chip manufacturer under your belt, yes, to do anything. All those missiles aren't going to fly themselves.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, luckily you came back in the nick of time to start a family, and
It was the right choice all the way. And it was a different lifestyle at that point.
So wait, you moved back in 97?
So late 97, moved back, and that was to Taiwan for good. I was not traveling working for Jet anymore, so I was full time in Taiwan.
I see.
And my wife Shay had already started her business. She started it from the ground up, a school. First, it was for younger kids, but it expanded, and she had all the way up to high school and even adult classes in the evening. But it was a school. It's what they call a bushi ban, and it's a cram school. But they have all grade levels. When the kids get out of school, they got to go there and study, and then they get a snack, and then they do their homework, and they have tutoring and all that stuff. And so she was the big boss and brains behind that whole thing. And when I got back, I started working there full time to help the school grow, and was teaching English.
That's what I remember.
Yeah, I was teaching. I'd never been a teacher. I had no, virtually no training. I had tutored before, but I had never been a full-time English teacher. And it was, it was, again, Forrest Gump. What am I doing here? Seriously. But
he just breezed into an English teacher
in Taiwan.
It was wild, but we became stars of the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, because the thing is, a lot of foreigners do come and go from there, and there's a lot of them that come and teach English on a contract, and they have they probably teach more of a part time, and then they have a lot of free time where they can travel, and that's why they do it. Doesn't pay a lot, but they don't have people to stick around that much, and I stayed there for quite a few years.
Yep,
and it was a great experience.
And was she ready to leave, or was that upsetting? Like, was she okay with coming, or was she kind of like, I'd rather not, but I'll go?
I know, right? So I think that it's both. I think she was very excited to do that, but I think she's also got to give up a lot of what she built in that school. She had more than one branch. There was a main school, but she had other branches, and so it was quite a business, dozens of teachers. And
wow.
And so she sold the school, and that was a really difficult thing. And I came back earlier than her because I was trying to get set up again over here. And it's it takes a little while to plug yourself back in and be able to support a family after living the life that we had lived up to that point. But, change, it comes. You just got to be ready to adapt.
You roll with the punches. It's amazing.
So music was out of the story at that point of my life. It was focus on the family at that point.
And then when...
That's cool.
So when we started playing again, had you picked up the guitar before that? Like again?
When you were over there, did you not play music at all?
Pretty much no. I didn't have, a little bit, just a little tiny bit. I played, but nothing that amounted to anything as far as like not even playing gigs, just right. jamming with a couple of different people.
Right.
But yeah, it was a real dead zone for me musically. I was trying, I was desperately trying to get music recorded and to play with other people and create something. But I was in a world in Asia where, you know, the kind of music that I like is much more of a small niche. You know, it's definitely not on TV or the radio. And on top of that, it's mostly not in English. So, right. you know, I had friends. I had made connections with Jet Li and people in Rock Records in Taiwan. And they were like the biggest like label that would have anything like I would consider music, like rock and roll style music. And they had a couple big artists on there. And so they also had licensing deals with other bands. So Brandon Finley, our old J drummer, right, was playing in this band called Dog Eat Dog from New Jersey. And they were like kind of like a hardcore, you know, almost like a Limp Bizkit style music. And they came out, I would reckon, at the same time or maybe earlier than Limp Bizkit, maybe. They were on Roadrunner Records and had a big following and did really well in Europe, but not so much in America. So, you know, he was doing that kind of a gig and playing, and, you know, I was, they were, their record got distribution in Asia from Rock Records, the Taiwan label. And so when I was in Hong Kong, met up with those guys. They had flown them over there to do some, you know, PR and do some gigs and stuff. And so here I am sitting right behind my drummer. Rocking these gigs out to all these little teeny boppers in these places and going crazy. And I was like, man, I wish I was in this band doing this with these guys. But it just, the timing wasn't right. So, right. you know, it's a weird thing. Music is a beautiful thing. It's magical. And if you get the right people, you've really got to hold on to it. Because if you let it go, it just dissolves. It dissipates.
And it's a shame.
Quickly, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Yeah. Well, it's weird because you were always known. I mean, I knew, but you were always a really great guitarist. And so it's just weird to me. Like, I always feel like you must have had your guitar 24/7 your whole life, but it ain't like that. You know, you had it 24/7 your whole life for 10 years or 15 years, and then you put it down for 15 years, and then you picked it up again. Or you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, it gets foggy. Once you stop doing something, you know, all that, you know, muscle memory is kind of there. It's like riding a bike, I guess, but still, you know, I mean, you're not going to be at peak performance. So for me, I just kind of felt like the more I it got separated from playing with other people and going to shows and seeing live music myself, the harder it was to figure out what I wanted to do with music. You know, it's like, I don't even know. Do I want to play rockabilly? Do I want to play jazz? What the heck am I going to do? Because I feel like I'm almost starting from scratch. But, you know, I did start to get to a point where it's like I realized that musically, my true heart lies with where I really started. So, you know, that was kind of the decision that, you know, if I have to play anything, I want it to be my own music. I don't, if I'm playing other music, I'm doing it because I want to, or it's there's something I get out of it. It, you know, it's usually not a paycheck, to be honest. It's never a
paycheck.
Nice to be recognized and to have someone say, here's some money for what you did. I mean, who doesn't want that?
Right.
But usually it's not like enough where it's going to make a significant difference in my life.
Right.
So it's more of this like, well, do I have fun playing this with people? Do I get to keep my chops up? You know, am I learning how to put on a better show for people? And to me, at the very worst, it's paid rehearsal to play other people's music for people that enjoy it. So the fact that they enjoy it makes it worth it to me, and I get to
make, you know, a little
become
side
a better chart. Musician. Right, yeah.
right.
So
it's a win-win.
But the I think legacy, now that I'm getting older, is like, you know, I want to leave something behind that people that I may never know, probably will never know, that are related to me will find terribly fascinating. Wow, maybe some of them might like the music. Who knows what it could inspire? I would love to know this kind of private information about my ancestors, but I never will. But the younger generations today and in the future are going to have overload of information.
Digital record.
Yeah, yeah. They're going to be like good, bad, and the ugly. They're going to know more about us than we do.
Well, so that,
well, this is documented right here. We're doing it right now.
Right. Yeah, so legacy, right.
So that's going to lead us here to the Gravedigger's Biscuits, the start of a legacy. Now, before we get into it, so I haven't told you this, and I keep forgetting, and it's not like a huge deal, but it's just one of those weird serendipitous things that is just so funny. So
I'm ready.
We lay down the Gravedigger's Biscuits tracks last year, and we don't really sing. He or I or Ryan, we do, but we were thinking of a front guy for that band.
This is original music.
Of original songs, right? So we go in the studio, we throw it down, and it's good. It's great stuff. We got four good tracks.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, like a month ago.
Five good tracks.
A month ago, he texts me out of nowhere, and he's like, you'll never guess who got a hold of me and wants to be like the front man of Gravediggers. He wants to put his own spin on it. Chris Roten.
Okay. Curtis's brother.
Curtis's older brother, the lead singer.
Of
From the Hills.
Yes. What?
I swear to God, dude. Chris Roten is right now working with Jay to be the front man of Gravedigger's Biscuits.
So you know what that means.
I do know what that means.
You know what I'm going to say?
You're going to say we're going to be covering...
You're going to cover two songs.
We're going to cover some From the Hills, baby.
Yeah, 12 quarters.
12 quarters and pickup truck.
I wrecked my pickup truck.
I would do either of those.
I demand it.
Can you believe that, though?
No, that's awesome.
He,
that's
out of nowhere, he's like Chris Roten. Actually, he had this band.
How did you forget to tell me
I reached out to him. Yeah, I just did. Because every once in a while we run into each other or something, but we just really never talked about playing in a band together. And so I just reached out to him. I was like, hey, man, how you doing? Check this music out. See if you like it. You know, you could write some lyrics to it. Join the group, you know.
Right, right.
And no, so he took it from there. Yeah.
That's great news.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, like, no, this is...
Out of all the serendipity.
Is,
like,
oh, my God. This
yeah,
is,
so the Iron Boss from the Hills.
Yeah, he's an Iron Boss.
Right, no, I forgot about that. That's I forgot about that.
Right, I mean, Curtis. Like, I haven't thought about Curtis in
this is amazing.
I remember seeing Iron Boss when I got back. This was in the early 2000s. They were opening for Clutch at the Wrecker in Towson.
Are they still around?
That was a great show.
Who? Clutch?
Iron Balls.
Oh, Iron
no,
Balls.
No, they're not. Yeah. But, but after that, they formed From the Hills.
Oh, God. Yeah. From the Hills. What an incredible debut.
Oh, that is Carroll County Rock.
Oh, well, my God.
You know, he's supposedly got some of the lyric, most of the lyrics ready. So he said he's happy with them.
I cannot fucking wait.
There's one track that has a riff in it that's a little bit derivative of Ace of Spades.
Oh, nice. Really?
And I think that's the one that he mentioned. He's got a working title for it. It's called Space of AIDS.
I mean, have you heard him sing recently? Has he still got it? I
haven't heard shit, but
so when are you going to be recording this? Because I'm definitely going to be there.
Well, something cool has happened, and that is he's had a lot of health problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, for like broken bones, all that motocross stuff that he's known for. So he's had all kinds of injuries, and he's recently gotten all this work done, and he's fixed up, and he says he's like, brand new.
Awesome.
It's like Bionic Man or something. So I'm like, wow.
This is
a
$6 million man.
We need a front man who can hop around a little bit.
Gravedigger's Biscuits, baby. We're coming at you live. Yeah. Well, look, man, I mean, I'm just enthralled that we're together. We're still doing it. For the cheap seats, there are four Gravedigger's Biscuits tracks that are on YouTube right now. Five or four? We recorded five, but there's only
the three with vocals, because we had two other songs we didn't do any vocals to.
Right.
So they're instrumental. They're badass songs.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, they're instrumental.
Everybody that hears the theme song loves it.
Right. And then we did the theme song just not too long ago.
That was a lot of fun.
In
doing
Black
it,
Dog Studios.
It's great, man. Yes. I love putting the music into the episode.
I know. And I think it works perfectly.
Oh, it's great.
I mean, it's fucking wonderful. Dude.
That's why it's fun to just roll with stuff, because that version of it sounds very different than the other version that we played.
And that's a song that you've kind of had like on the shelf.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, we recorded it, I think. Well, did we record that one?
That's one of the two songs that we didn't have any vocals for.
Okay, I would say, but we did it like the way we did it here and layered his his solos and Ron was doing different songs.
We just made it up as we went along.
Yeah, like it was.
No, it's great.
It works
perfectly.
Better.
I mean, the first time I heard it, I was kind of mind blown, and I could just picture the beginning
of
the intro. Like everything just came together.
I know. As it was happening, I'm going.
And it has. Like, that's how it works now.
Even while we were in the studio, like with Ron, me, and Jason, I'm going, Chris. You know, Chris is going, what? You know, and I'm going, listen, bam. Like it just seemed right, you know.
I mean, it works, and it's great.
But look, I love you to death, man, and I'm very happy that hopefully we can add some legacy, you know, to the Lepo family name here going on, and you know, and maybe we'll get the biscuits in the lounge for live at the lounge.
100%, yeah.
As long as it involves live show, then. Yeah, because I love to record, but there's that connection with the audience that you make when you play live.
You were always Billy Zoom. You were always the Billy Zoom.
My favorite, yes. Yeah. Yes.
From X, right?
The wide, Billy Zoom from X.
The wide stance, just.
And the big grin.
Yep.
Yeah, the big grin. Just sitting there and grin. You know why he does that? He says it's because. During the day, back in the day, now, you know, he's a little bit of an older cat, right? You know,
he's way older.
Yeah, he's like in his 70, I want to say 75.
Damn.
Yeah, he's older now. But he was saying back in his day when all the guitar players were trying to jam, they'd always make these contorted, agonized faces while they're playing. And he says it was so hard what they're doing. He's like, he just wanted to be the complete opposite and make it look like it was just nothing. So he just sat there and smiled the whole time.
Wide stance. Yeah, look up footage of Billy Zoom. Like, I mean, it's.
Well, he was just the king of cool, man. He had like, he looked like Rucker Hauer. You know, he looked like, didn't he? He had like that like platinum hair and his big blue eyes and the giant smile and that the silver leather jacket on, and he's playing that Sparkle Top Gretsch, man. Mm-hmm. What's not to love,
and
dude?
X is the band that is your John Doe. Is the guy who's the bartender in Roadhouse.
Yeah.
Remember the smarmy guy with the mustache? Right? John Doe is the lead singer of bass. Does he play bass in that?
Plays bass, yeah. Really? He's a hell of a bass player.
Yeah, that's where he was from. Like when he showed up in Roadhouse, everybody's like, is that John Doe from X?
Wild.
Yeah.
Well, you remember the singer, Xene Cervenka.
I loved her.
You know, she was married to Viggo Mortensen for a while.
What?
They have two kids together.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right?
That's incredible.
Aragon.
Los Angeles?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's awesome.
I know. It's a small world when you start to find out who knows who.
That's
who's
incredible, dude. Well, look, I love you to death. I'm happy that we're doing this. I'm happy you did it, and I'm happy you're involved. And hopefully
man, it was great. They were fantastic, you know, stories.
Yeah, I mean, you're like a smarter Forrest Gump. I mean, you know, more ambitious.
I give him a run for his money. Run, Forrest.
Right. All right, man. Well, I love you. And that's it. Till next time. Stay sane, Baltimore.
Yep.
Thanks for listening, Baltimore. You can find us at www.sanitylounge.com or on Instagram at sanity.lounge.
Keep listening and subscribe.
Stay sane, Baltimore.